can it be that you can challenge God and do it as an act of faith? What about the Jewish tradition of wrestling with God?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is your Thoroughly Jewish host, Michael Brown. Welcome to the broadcast. We've got some really neat things to talk about today, some eye-opening truths from Scripture, some interesting Jewish tradition. We'll be taking your Jewish-related calls as well, and updates on Iran, the United States, things happening in the Middle East with Israel, more attacks. A lot to talk about. Here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Any Jewish-related questions you have, if you're a Jewish person who doesn't believe in Jesus and you want to chat with me about that or challenge some of my views, if you're a Christian that doesn't understand the importance of Israel, just have a Jewish-related question. Phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH. We'll continue with questions about the book of Job, too, because that will tie in with what we're talking about. So if you've got any Job-related questions, this is a great day to call. But first, some breaking news. Friends, this is news right now taking place from Kentucky. A federal judge has held Kim Davis, the Rowan County clerk, has held her in contempt of court, sentenced her to jail until she agrees to sign marriage licenses for same-sex couples. Let's be praying for her. Let's be letting her know that we are standing with her. I want to say this plainly, though, as plainly as I can. My book, Outlasting the Gay Revolution, it's just coming out now. I wrote it for these very reasons, friends. Principle number one in the book, never compromise your convictions. And I end that chapter by saying it's time to face reality, friends. We are now codified as bigots. We are now in a position while just holding to our convictions and doing what Americans would have thought normal and proper for generations could now land us in jail. Principle number one, never compromise your convictions. Principle number four, refuse to redefine marriage. I believe if we stand strong, if we walk in love, no matter what we are called, no matter what's said about us, and that's principle number two of the book, take the highest moral ground. If we continue to walk in love no matter what, if we continue to stand for truth no matter what, if we continue to be light in the midst of darkness in the society, no matter what the cost or the consequence, I believe that the bullying against us will backfire. I lay out the evidence in the book, friends. I wrote it because I knew that this was the great cultural crisis of the hour. And this book will explain why we need to stand firm in faith while walking in love towards all, but with great hope that God will turn the tide. We can outlast the gay revolution. But friends, there's going to be a price to pay. And in the midst of it, we have to continue to demonstrate sacrificial love in the midst of our differences. It's time for awakening. It's time for God to move. I appeal to each one of you. Let's wake up. Let's consider the cost. Let's examine our own lives. Let's give ourselves to prayer and fasting for awakening and for outpouring of the Spirit on those who identify as LGBT. This is the great issue of our era. How will we respond? We can, by God's grace, outlast the gay revolution. All right, friends, our focus, Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I'm going to come back and talk to you about some fascinating traditions having to do with challenging God as an act of faith. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Can I take you into my world for one moment? Can I take you into my world, my personal world of ministry and writing and radio and burdens that I live with? This is Michael Brown, and it is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Okay. I just finished my Job commentary, as you know. I mentioned that yesterday. Sent it into the publisher 3:03 in the morning, Tuesday night. So it was due out on the 1st. I told them I'd get it by the end of the day. So basically from 10 to 3 in the morning, I just did my final editing of the book. Sometimes I've had 12-hour runs. This was only a 5-hour run. But got it done, sent it off. So last night, I said to Nancy, you know, I'm just going to chill. I just finished this, a massive project, and especially in recent months, it's intensified to get it done. I'm writing 3, 4, 5 articles every week, and then some other projects I'm working on. Just want to chill. Well, what I ended up doing, I ended up writing. I was just so burdened. I was so burdened, and I wanted to. It wasn't like, you have to do this, you've required. No, I was excited to. I was eager to. Why? Because of the burden, because of the vision, because of the sense of having a message to get out. So that's just the world I live in. When I'm eager to get on radio and start and talk about cutting edge key subjects, it's not that I'm paid to do this. In fact, my salary within our ministry did not change when we added in 1 hour, then 2 hours of live radio 5 days a week. Didn't change. Nothing else changed. I was still traveling, still speaking, still writing, still doing everything else, still teaching. We added in a massive commitment. Nothing changed because it's for calling. So I tell you that the same thing with books that I write. Yeah, I want to sell a lot of books, but not to make a lot of money. In fact, for years, almost all my books' royalties were not paid to me, but to my ministry. So if a book did really well, it blessed the ministry, but it didn't personally impact me. So the point I'm making is I talk about books that I've written because I'm burning to get the message out because I believe it's critical. You know, you take something like Job. I could, listen to me, the amount of hours that you work on a scholarly academic book, okay? The amount of hours that you work on that and what you get for it, if I put in that many hours at McDonald's, working at McDonald's, I'd be rich in comparison. Rich in comparison. So, writing 5 volumes on answering Jewish objections for Jesus, all the years of research and study, learning the Jewish sources and interacting with the Jewish community and writing the books, you don't do that to make a buck. And then I don't get money from the royalties anyway. They're just paid to the ministry. So when I'm urging folks to get a copy of Outlasting the Gay Revolution, it's because it's of critical importance, because I know it speaks to the situation that we're in. Think of it. Kim Davis prayerfully says, I can't issue a certificate. It's going to have my name on it. The attorneys with Liberty Counsel came up with various solutions to get around this so people could still get their licenses, but it wouldn't have to come from her or her office, and those were shot down. And she, you know, people say, oh, she's doing it for the attention. She's doing it because she wants to get rich from this and famous, and she's going to be the martyr, and she's going to have a book tour. From what I could see from the video, and as she's called a bigot by one of the gay guys, she did not want to be in the spotlight and is uncomfortable with the spotlight. And how would you feel? You're getting death threats from people you don't even know. Now you end up in jail? Are you kidding me? Jail? Well, she's ultimately going to get richer. First, you don't think like that and plan like that. Most people are not public people. Most people are not looking for a confrontation. Most people are not looking for a fight. And the amount of people who are now going to make money off of this, come on, most people that have gone through this have suffered, and it's been miserable, miserable for them. And what they have lost is something that they were not expecting to lose when this whole thing broke out. So the same on my end. When I encourage you to get a book, when I urge you to get a book, when I talk about it, it's because I wrote it with a sense that it was of critical importance, and I know if people read it, it'll build their faith, it'll give them the tools they need, and it'll help us bring about change through the gospel. 866-34-TRUTH. Before I go to the phones, want to just mention to you, in my Job commentary, which is scheduled to come out next November is when it's scheduled to come out. I have five essays at the end of the commentary. One of them is on challenging God as an act of faith. I want to introduce this subject to you and then get into it a little bit more as we go on in the broadcast. And I start by saying this: while many readers are put off by Job's verbal attacks on God, attacks that cannot be softened by translators due to their directness and intensity, others recognize those very attacks as reflections of Job's faith. Jewish readers in particular, while sensitive to effrontery against the deity, and while recognizing his sovereignty, are more apt to embrace the tradition of wrestling with God, especially in the post-Holocaust era. So to be clear, religious Jews believe in being reverential towards God. Religious Jews believe that it's sin to speak evil of God. Religious Jews believe that whatever comes their way is the hand of God. Even absolute tragedy and horrific events, they would say that's the hand of God. And yet, there is a Jewish tradition of wrestling with God. And that's why it's not surprising that it was a Jewish rabbi, Irving Greenberg, who responded forcefully to the charge that the Holocaust was simply the result of Jewish sin. This is a very intense quote. It's a very intense quote. Are you ready? So he said, moreover, summing up the principle that no statement should be made that could not be made in the presence of the burning children. In other words, whatever theological argument you're going to advance, don't try to advance it unless you can advance it in the presence of children being burned alive in the Holocaust. Remember, the Nazis sometimes, one of their methods of extermination would be to have the Jewish prisoners dig a long, big pit, and then they would stand by the pit, and then the Nazis would shoot them. Of course, they'd fall into the pit, next one's body on top of body on top of body, and then they would set the bodies on fire. But when it came to babies, why waste a bullet when you could just throw the baby in alive? This was actually done. And that's what Irving Greenberg says, summing up the principle that no statement should be made that could not be made in the presence of the burning children, because there were traditional rabbis who say that the Holocaust happened because of Jewish sin. He said, on this rock, the traditionalist argument, meaning that the Holocaust was a divine judgment, on this rock, the traditionalist argument breaks. Tell the children in the pits they were burning for their sins. An honest man, better a decent man, would spit at such a God rather than accept this rationale if it were true. If this justification is loyalty, then surely treason is the honorable choice. If this were the only choice, then surely God would prefer atheism. You say, that's an extreme quote. Yes, but it's in the tradition of the book of Job. As Job suffers things that were actually from Satan's hand, yes, with God's permission and ultimate orchestration, but from Satan's hand. And Job says to God that you're acting like a monster, and challenges him. On the one hand, he's totally out of order and totally out of line to think that he can lecture God and tell God what's right and what's wrong. On the other hand, he's absolutely right to say that's not in keeping with the character of God. And there is a righteous act of faith. Are you grasping this? An act of faith that says, God, if this is from you, then you would be denying yourself. If you are the one doing these things, for example, if the God of ISIS was the God of the Bible, we could challenge that. We could say, no, that's not who you are. You're not leading these men as an expression of faith and devotion to behead innocent men, women, and children. That's not the kind of God that you are. Challenging God as an act of faith. Even this statement, it's a seemingly atheistic statement, if you could understand it rightly, could be coming from a wounded heart of faith. It was from a concentration camp, and this was written there. If there is a God, by one of the prisoners, if there is a God, he will have to beg my forgiveness. On the one hand, irreverent, out of line. On the other hand, you understand what he's saying, that this does not line up with the character of a loving heavenly Father. So there's a key to this. I'll come back to that key and we'll take your calls on the other side of the break.
Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown. Every 7 years in ancient Israel was the Shemitah, but every 49 years was the seventh Shemitah. The seventh Shemitah carries its own significance because it ushers in what the Bible calls the year of Jubilee.
Thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire. This is Michael Brown, 866-34-TRUTH. And you're hearing a lot about the seventh year of the Shemitah, the year of Jubilee, the 50th year, the four blood moons. Is it just the latest prophecy mania? Look, I got saved in 71. Jesus is coming any minute. Come on, I was 16 then. I'm 60 now. Our oldest granddaughter turns 15 in January. I was saved when I was 16. I mean, you're talking about two generations. And is this the latest prophecy mania? Or is God trying to get our attention? I honestly believe God is trying to get our attention, friends. I honestly believe, regardless of how you interpret the scriptures, whether there's any relevance from the biblical calendar and the seventh year of release to the cycles in America and the striking correspondence that Jonathan Cahn has documented with the seventh year being on the biblical calendar, exactly when we've had these massive stock market collapses, and why at the certain time of the year in the fall, and boy, it makes sense. You say, yeah, but I can't see a correspondence between the biblical laws in America today. How about the correspondence being that the calendar, the clock is still ticking? How about the correspondence being that God is seeking to get our attention? 866-34-TRUTH. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, so check out the resource offer. If you go to my website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, right on the homepage, you can click to check that out, and you can watch some footage from the Mystery of the Shemitah Unlocked DVD, and then the book comes with it, so we've got a great resource package just this week, so check it out at askdrbrown.org. Let us go to the phones. Jonathan in Barrhead, Alberta. Hey, buddy, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Doing very well, thanks.
Right on. My question today was that in the Bible it talks about that when Israel went to Egypt, they were in there 400 years. But then I heard at Passover there in the synagogue they say that they're only there for 210 years, just going through genealogies. Just wondering your opinion on that.
Yeah, well, genealogies will sometimes have gaps and skip over things. And even if it looks like it's consecutive, it's not going to be consecutive. There's no way it could have been that short. Let's just look at the different dates for the Exodus from Egypt. The traditional date put it in the mid-1400s B.C. That was based on a period of 480 years from the Exodus to the building of Solomon's Temple, which 1 Kings tells us. And Solomon's Temple, if that was dated to around 966, so that puts you then in around 1446 B.C., all right? That would then, if you say that Joseph going down into Egypt and Jacob, the family coming down to Egypt, was roughly 400 years earlier. That would put that in the mid-1800s, and that would push Abraham back to around 2000, roughly, which works out fine. In other words, that works out, there's no problem. Many scholars, however, believe that that 480 number is just a round number of 12 times 40, as if it meant 12 generations, and that it's not an actual counting number like we would think. And sometimes numbering systems use things differently. And they say the archaeological evidence points more to an exodus a couple hundred years after that, you know, maybe in the 1230s or something like that. So if that's the case, then that would move Abraham back up a little bit to 1800 something, and the what would be called the Isidus, the going down into Egypt, the 1600s, and that's possible. I think arguments can be made for the older date that's been used, but one way or another, you're still going to have them there about 400 years. Now, the other thing is that you have Genesis 15 addressing that. Genesis 15 is addressing that that very fact of what's going to happen. Now, again, it could be that the numbers are used more roundly. The word generation can refer either to a certain shorter period of time, as in, you know, how long it is from father to son generation, or based on some other Semitic usage, it could refer to roughly a 100-year period. And what we see in Genesis 15, God says to Abram, as for you, you'll go to your fathers in peace, you'll be buried in a good old age, and then they shall come back here in the fourth generation. Well, fourth generation, how in the world do you get 400 years? Well, based on some other Semitic usage, that's been argued that it means 100 years each. So come here in the fourth generation, meaning 400 years later, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. And then Paul in Galatians 3 says that the law, which was 430 years after the promise, couldn't annul the promise. So that would point to the 400-year issue. But, you know, it depends on when you're dating it, when Joseph first went down, or when Jacob settled, or once everyone was in Egypt. You know, some of that's debated, but 400 right. years roughly seems more reliable than the 200 years.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Hey, do you have time for another quick question?
Yeah, real quick. Sure.
From an Israeli point of view, where are their borders? Like, are they including in the state of Israel? Are they including the West Bank, and are they including the Gaza Strip? And I'm just trying to look at it from their like political point of view. I'm not trying to raise, you know, controversy here or whatever, but I'm just trying to understand: are the Palestinians living in their land as refugees, type of thing?
Yeah, it all depends on who you talk to. There are some who just say, hey, let's work out things and let them have their own state. Those who opt for a one-state solution are not thinking about Gaza. It's like Gaza, just let them have Gaza, whatever. That's a separate thing. But let's have a one-state solution between the Israelis and the Palestinians in the West Bank or in Judea, Samaria. But many Israelis would say that it's all of it is Israel. It's our land. And we were in a war, and during the war, we expanded and took that territory, just like some of America is the size it is because of territory taken in war. Many other countries, right. That's the way it is. And, hey, so we have our borders, and Palestinians are living in our country, and if they don't want to kill us, then we could all be friends and neighbors and live together. It all depends on who you talk to. There are some very left-wing Israelis, and they're more thinking that that's theirs, let them have it.
So from Benjamin Netanyahu's point of view, would the West Bank, is that part of their country and they're just having to work with the Palestinians there?
Well, Israel does control it. I mean, Israel does control it. Israel has sovereignty over it. And they have to let the water supplies and other things like that be done, and they have military control over it. But others look at it as an occupation. So if he says two-state solution, then he would, in that sense, be capitulating and say, okay, we're willing to lose that. All right. Thanks for the calls and questions. We're going to continue another hour and a half.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the line of fire, 866-34-TRUTH. A little bit more on this tradition of wrestling with God. Here's the principle. Here's the principle. God, having created us in his image, which means that we should love justice and be repulsed by evil, welcomes pushback from his faithful ones when he appears to be acting unjustly. This is from an appendix in my Job commentary, scheduled to come out next November. So November 2016, trying to figure out what year it is. Here's the principle. God, having created us in his image, which means that we should love justice and be repulsed by evil, welcomes pushback from his faithful ones when he appears to be acting unjustly. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to Chate in Seattle,
yep.
Washington. I got the name right, didn't I?
Sure
I got
did.
It
yep,
right.
Yeah, I love it.
All right.
I love
there
it.
There we
doing,
go.
Man?
I'm doing
How
good.
Doing?
Thanks. Doing
good,
well.
Good. So I wrote this question down because I'm having a little trouble understanding how to phrase it. Hopefully I phrase it correctly. But it's based on Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4. So I'm going to read this real quick. It's really short. Not that it's the verse of my question. So these four verses, is there any sense in which it would be evil to tell a woman to be reconciled to her first husband in light of Deuteronomy 21, verse 1 through 4? And then when it says, God says it is detestable / an abomination, depending on what version you're using. Is it an abomination for a woman to go back to her first husband after being a certificate of divorce, after being given a certificate of divorce? And then is the situation even possible today? This is based on a discussion that I was having with someone about a woman who had some divorce before she became a Christian and then is now currently married. And it was kind of right. A sidetracking discussion. They cited divorce.
Hey, look, Kim Davis, the county clerk in Kentucky, who has just been sentenced to jail, being found in contempt. All the governor has to do there is say, hey, we'll have religious exemptions. If you can't do this in good conscience, we'll have others do it. That's fine. And everybody can live happily together. Instead, federal judge right now has sentenced her to jail and says you're going to stay there until you write out these marriage licenses. Now, I bring that up because people say, well, you're married four times.
Right.
True, she was married three times.
That's
right,
what it was based off of.
Right, yeah, she was married multiple times before she was a believer. Came to faith 4.5 years ago. And obviously would say that she's supposed to be married to her husband for the rest of her life. So does God forgive the sins that we committed before we're saved? Of course. Does he remove all the consequences? No, but sometimes he might. In other words, let's say I stole a lot of money from banks before I was saved and got away with it. Then I got saved. Okay, God forgives me. He looks at me as a righteous child of God, as if I never committed those sins. I'm clean in his sight. Yet, my conscience will convict me and the Holy Spirit will convict me. I need to go back and confess. I need to go to the police and say, I stole this money, etc. I might go to jail for it. It's possible that someone could say, or the banks could say, hey, we see the change in your life. And if you'll do this community service, you know, for the next year, then we're not going to press charges against you. Something like that could happen. So with divorce, as I view it, if you were divorced and remarried and reconciliation is impossible with your previous spouse or your original spouse, and that's impossible, is it possible then to move on with new life and to be married? I believe so. I believe that that's part of forgiveness and a brand new start. Others differ, and they say, no, that's just like robbing the bank. You still have the consequences of it. Now, what about Deuteronomy 24? I'll take that up when we come back. Everybody else, stay right there. I want to get to every one of your calls.
God of burning, cleansing flame, send the fire.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. So, Chate, back to your question. So Deuteronomy 24 lays things out, and a lot of these laws, which seem strange to us, often have the protection of the woman in mind. For example, the ancient Israelite law that if a man raped a woman, that if the father so desired it, that he would be required to marry her and have her for the rest of her life, that was done for the woman, because a raped woman would have then been untouchable. No one would have ever married her. She would have been shamed for the rest of her life. This was a way of saying, now you must take the responsibility for it. There are still some countries, I've read about it in Africa, where that's the law, and it's for the protection of the woman, whereas in our culture, we think that's the worst possible thing to do to a woman. Deuteronomy 24, when a man takes a wife, marries her, finds no favor in his eyes because he's found some indecency in her, writes her certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, sends her out of his house. She departs out of his house, goes, becomes another man's wife. The latter man hates her, writes her certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, sends her out of his house. If the latter man dies, he took her to be his wife. Then a former husband who sent her away may not take her, again to be his wife after she's been defiled, for that is an abomination before the Lord. So it seems that it is something disgraceful, something wrong that's being done in the treatment of the woman. And this is to protect her and probably to slow that man down from the initial divorce. Now, here's what's fascinating. Jesus did tell us this was not God's ideal, but the whole divorce provision was there because of the hardness of hearts. There never should have been divorce according to God's ideal. That's number one. Number two is that the texts in Jeremiah 3 and 4 are used by the rabbis of the Talmud to say that repentance overrules that, because God sends Israel away. Israel then, quote, marries others, right? And then Israel says, come back. God says to Israel, come back to me. But you can't. It's a violation of this. But he says, repent and come back. And the rabbis deduced from that repentance would even nullify that decree. My understanding of the gospel and how this would work itself out would be that through the gospel, redemption and reconciliation would be the greatest goal. And if there was true repentance wherever there had been sin, that God could reunite them, and that would actually be a great story and testimony. Hey, always good to hear from you. And let's see if I remember to pronounce your name correctly the next time around. See, what I have to remember is when I see CH and it's an unusual name, I think Hebrew, and that's Ch. That's a Ch sound. So that's the first thing I think when I see it. I got to remember. No, not my buddy from Seattle. All right, God bless. 866-34-TRUTH. Silver Spring, Maryland. Danette, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown.
You're welcome.
I am truly interested in your program, and I'm grateful for all that you've been able to teach and impart unto us. I wanted to say, in support of Kim Davis, that what she did was a wonderful, courageous thing. It took a boldness from God for her to do what she has done. And even though they are preparing to make her have to go to jail for whatever period of time, the same God that gave her the boldness to stand on the principles that were taught from the scriptures, God will keep her and sustain her. I support what she has done, and I am praying for her and for all of those who believe in God through Jesus Christ, that he will keep her and keep those of us.
Amen.
That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, thank you. And for folks who missed this, we announced early in the broadcast, even though it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, breaking news that Kim Davis, the county clerk in Kentucky, who said that in good conscience she could not issue marriage certificates to same-sex couples, so she just stopped her office from issuing any marriage certificates to anyone. She has now been sentenced to jail and told that she will stay there until she issues such certificates. So it's a great test of faith, and prayers and solidarity will make a difference. And Danette, let's realize, you know, people like me, I'm a fighter, you know, and I'm called to debate and be on the front lines and challenge things, hopefully always in a Christ-like way. But the idea of, okay,
you
might go to jail.
You're a surgeon warrior.
Yeah, and so it's you know, everyone has different callings. One person's called to stay in the back and pray. Another person's called to stand up front and speak. Another person's called to organize the event, you know. So like me, okay, so you get threatened with jail. You get threatened with that. That almost makes you come alive all the more. Are you doing the right thing? But not everybody's like that. Not everybody's ready for the spotlight. Not everybody's called to be there. So you get someone like this who's, you know, been minding their own business in that respect. I know the gays and lesbians, it seems like bigotry and hatred, and you know, we're not willing to recognize what the Supreme Court has given them, and we're against equality and all that. I understand that, and that's the challenge, that we still want to walk in love and reach out to everyone while being despised for our convictions. But, you know, from my reading of this, from my reading of her personal story and watching just the little video clips, she's not relishing this. She's not relishing suddenly being the center of attention and death threats.
No, I know that.
Yeah, so I say that to reinforce what you're saying, that this could be a challenging time, and it's very easy to cave in. I don't know what she has in terms of family and things like that she'd be separated from, whether it's for a day or a week or a month or who knows how long. But the support, the sympathy with her, just as you're saying, and prayer for her will make a difference. And yes, she stood up to obey the Lord, and that same Lord will give her the grace. Thank you for taking the time to call in, and I know you'll be praying for her. Many others will. Thank you. And let's be praying for, let this be another reminder to pray for an outpouring of the Spirit among those who identify as gay and lesbian, that the Lord would pour out his mercy and bring in a massive harvest of salvation. All right, we go to Phoenix, Arizona. Bill, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
In the subject of wrestling with God, I'm very curious about Jacob in chapter 32 of Genesis. Since the word Penuel seems to be consensus that the word means to look up or look away from and to see God face to face, that the person he was wrestling with was actually an angel or an angel posing as a man. Therefore, what do you think in regards to the fact that the Bible seems to indicate it was a man that appeared? And, of course, and therefore, when we also take on the idea of wrestling with God in prayer, isn't it telling us that we need to be discerning as to whether we're following after some angel that's not in the will of God coming to us, or whether it's a truly sent angel of God to
Interesting question. I don't know that I've been asked that question that particular way. Great. So first, yes, it does say he wrestled with a man, but then Hosea, the 12th chapter, tells us that it was an angel. And as an angel, it was bearing the presence of God. Now, an angel, malach in Hebrew, means a messenger. Sometimes that angel can be the Son of God himself. Sometimes it can be a created being. But it is a man, and it is identified as an angel. So an angel who appeared as a man. But when Jacob wrestles with him, he says, I saw Peniel, which is the face of God. Peniel would be basically a byform of that for face of God. So the question, what about us, if we are spiritually wrestling? I wouldn't say that we are trying to figure out, are we wrestling with, say, a good angel or a bad angel, as much as what's the cause of the resistance. In other words, Bill, when I pray, when I cry out to God and seek his face, I am not wrestling with God in that respect. There's a wrestling with God where you're trying to wrestle through his will and wrestle through who he is and what he requires in a given situation and things like that. But if there's a spiritual battle, if there's spiritual warfare, understand that there's demonic resistance of some kind. So Ephesians, the 6th chapter, tells us we don't wrestle with flesh and blood, but with spiritual forces. So I recognize if there's resistance, if there's opposition to doing God's will, there's resistance and opposition to coming into his presence and obeying him. That's not being sent from above. That is demonic resistance, and you might have to press through that. You might have to take authority over the enemy. You might have to fast. You might have to take hold of promises of God's word, and in that respect, do spiritual warfare. You may have to join with other friends and come together in agreement for the power that comes as you agree together before the Lord. But as you do, changes will come. So in that sense, the wrestling we do, there's a type of spiritual wrestling with God that is healthy. But this resistance, this demonic thing, I'd say is satanic. And therefore, I would not look for us to have that same experience as Jacob did. Metaphorically, a spiritual battle, yes, but not that same experience of wrestling with the angel. Thanks, though. A great question.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Could there exist a mystery going back to ancient times that's been affecting, even molding our lives from the days we were born? From events of global proportions to the state of our bank accounts, our past, our present, and our future. And what does it foretell concerning what is yet to come? What is this mystery? It's called the Mystery of the Shemitah.
It's a really powerful DVD. It really is a really powerful DVD. When Jonathan Kahn was on the radio with me talking about it, he was amazed by how well produced it was. So we're excited to get that out to you together with the book, The Mystery of the Shemitah. Find out for yourself. Do the study. Read it through. Read the evidence. Look at the what's happened. I mean, these are the very weeks that some are talking about the cycle repeating itself. So we put together, because of the timeliness of it, a really great resource package that we believe will bless you, The Mystery of the Shemitah, and the book and the DVD that unlocks this even further. Very powerfully done. So go to the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. You can watch some of the video there. You can find out more. 866-34-TRUTH. Back to the phones on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We go to Frederick, Maryland. Larry, thanks for holding, and welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Michael Brown. I really appreciate your ministry. I know you do a great job. I know that the Lord's blessed you and blessed everyone who hears your ministry. I've gotten some of your books. I've been really impressed. Anyway, I have 2 points, but one quick question was, in Job, he's sacrificing daily, I think it was, for his children just in case they sin. It doesn't sound to me like he's in faith. It sounds like he's more in fear.
No, I don't read it like that. Some have said that. But it seems that he is being scrupulous. In other words, it's being presented, because remember, God says about him, there's no one like him on the whole earth, right?
Right.
So God singles him out. Because the devil's basically saying, hey, I'm strolling around here. Everything looks good to me. Looks like my world down here is doing pretty good. And God says, oh, yeah? What about Job? Well, there's nobody like him on earth. He fears God. He departs from evil. And in the second chapter, God commends Job for holding on to his integrity, even though Satan is moving God to inciting God to destroy him without cause. So when Job is sacrificing, he knows people are people. I just got an urgent prayer request last night. Christian couple with their son in his early 20s in a life and death situation related to sinful choices in his life. Here, you know, they have so much abundance, so much prosperity, everything going well. It's easy to take God for granted or to get carnal or to do wrong things. So Job is that scrupulous that he is sacrificing just in case he's going to be the high priest of his family. Yeah.
I never thought of it like that. That's a good point. Okay, my other quick point was, how can I put this? You know, I didn't challenge God, but I brought to his attention his word, his promises, because he's told us, you know, bring it to my attention what I've said. Because one night I was having a real difficult problem with condemnation and guilt. I won't go into all the details, but after struggling for hours, you know, trying to pray through, I got nowhere. And I finally said, Lord, do you hear me and do you even care? And, you know, Michael, as soon as I said that, because I really did mean it, I really meant what I said, maybe I was angry or a little bit frustrated for sure. But, as soon as I said that, the peace was in the room, the condemnation was gone. And a few minutes later, I got up and opened my Bible. I didn't thumb it. I just opened it to Isaiah 59 and 1. My eye went right to Isaiah 59 and 1. Not 59 and 2, but 59 and 1. And from that night on, for like 13 months, I didn't smoke any more cigarettes, and I never got high again. Now, after 13 months, I can't say I stayed that way. I still messed up. I said, you know, I threw a pity party and went over the edge again. But I've gotten past that since then.
Got it. So that was the breakthrough.
How God answered that prayer, and then He gave me confirmation by giving me the scripture to see it again.
Right. So to me, Larry, that's a perfect example that it depends on the attitude of the heart. In other words, one person could do it in defiance and anger and irreverence, and another person out of love for God. Like, God, do you even care? Are you even listening? It's like, of course I care. Of course I'm listening. But sometimes we get stretched to that point of desperation.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorite scriptures now, though. You know, behold, the arm of the Lord is not short that he cannot save, nor is ear heavy that he cannot hear. And that was exactly what my question was. Do you hear me, and do you care?
Yep, yes, sir.
And now I opened that Bible and went right to that scripture.
And then you had the confirmation in your life as well that something supernatural happened, and lo and behold, you find yourself free from cigarettes, drugs. I know you had some falls after it, but thank God you've moved past that. Yeah, it's a great illustration of what I'm talking about, this challenging God as an act of faith. Years and years ago, I was praying, and I just started to say, God, what about the... And I thought, that's not me. I said, Lord, you're good, you're wonderful, I don't doubt you, and I started to praise Him. I know other people, in their most wonderful, intimate times with God, they've really had it out. They've really had it out. And in a way that only God could understand. But when they were done, things were good between them. Great call. Thank you for it. I appreciate it. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Henrico, Virginia. Sheila, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Appreciate your work. I just have a question about the lady that been sentenced to court for refusing to issue licenses to the other side of the fence. Could she not just have quit her job, resigned her job, and avoid all of the riffraff? I mean, at the point that she was threatened with going to jail, could she not just have quit her job, resigned her job?
It's a very, very valid question. And sometimes you have to do that. Sometimes, you know, your company... takes a new viewpoint, or they take on a new contract, and that contract brings an ethical violation for you, and you ask if you can be exempt from it. No, and you say, okay, I'm going to have to step down. In this case, she prayed, and she felt it was important to take a stand. You know, the famous civil rights stand of Rosa Parks refusing to get up and give away her seat. There's sometimes a time to do it. Martin Luther King said sometimes things have to be dramatized. I don't know that she had thought it through on that level, but she was elected by the people. It was an elected position. She had served as a deputy clerk for many years. It was an elected position. She was committed to the job. The job entails many, many other things. And she felt that the law has now changed. She swore on oath to uphold it. Now things changed. And in her view, the laws of the state still never changed because the Supreme Court can't make laws. So her question was, by what law... am I required to do this? And felt that in conscience, and it was her job, and she was an elected official, been there a very long time, that this was not something she was just going to throw away and in her mind even walk away from the people. So it's a totally valid question. And sometimes in faith, loving the Lord, we have to just resign. We have to step away. Sometimes it happens in a church setting. You're an associate pastor. The pastor goes in a new direction, contrary to why he brought you on. You can't support it. You don't try to take over the church. You don't say, fire me. You say, okay, I'm going to have to step down and resign. But there are other times when it's right to stand. Thanks for raising that issue. My bottom line today, it's wrong to accuse God. It's wrong to attack God. But sometimes, out of a wounded heart, you speak strong words to Him, and they're words of faith. Can it be that you can challenge God and do it as an act of faith? What about the Jewish tradition of wrestling with God?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown here, delighted and blessed to be with you. This is the day when, if you have Jewish-related questions, you can call in. Still taking questions specifically on the book of Job, as I just submitted my commentary to the publisher, due out around November of next year. So if you've got a Job-related question, great. But any Jewish-related question, happy to take those questions. Any Hebrew-related question, anything relating to that, we're going to go for it. 866-34-TRUTH. And if you haven't heard the news, Kentucky County, Rowan County clerk in Kentucky, Kim Davis, sentenced to jail by a federal judge who said she is in contempt of court. The Supreme Court would not hold the Supreme Court refused to continue the stay earlier this week, and therefore she was required to issue, quote, marriage certificates to same-sex couples. She could not do it in good conscience before the Lord. She has been sentenced to jail. We'll have a video telling you more about that up not too much later today, where I respond to that in the first hour. Also, before I talk about this Jewish tradition of challenging God as an act of faith, I want to talk briefly about what's happening with Iran. And let's listen to a couple of quotes. Joey, number nine, this is Secretary of State John Kerry from yesterday on CNN. Interestingly, I was working out in the fitness room yesterday, and a couple of older couples came. Well, I'm not young, I'm 60, but a couple of other older couples came in there, and they were on the treadmill and different things like that. So they immediately go to put the TV on. I was working out with my trainer. We didn't have a TV on or anything. They put it on, and it's Secretary of State Kerry. And he's talking about Iran and why it's a great deal, all this. And one of them, one of the guys just says, I wish I could learn how to lie the way John Kerry lies, just with a smile. I mean, nobody was taking it seriously. But this is what Secretary of State Kerry had to say yesterday.
If this agreement were to be denied suddenly by the Congress unilaterally, after we have led the effort to negotiate it and we've joined in good faith with France, Germany, Britain, China, Russia, and Iran has signed up to this agreement, if the United States were to sort of unilaterally move away and say, oh, sorry, we're not going to do this, it would have profound implications that are very negative, I would judge, for our country and for the national security of a nation, but also for the security of the region. Iran would then be free to go do what it wants to do, having showed up in good faith to make an agreement, and it's the United States that somehow says, no, we're not going to live by this.
Ah, now, Lindsey Graham, Senator Graham, in response, this was September 1st on CNN, clip number 10.
This is a terrible deal. When somebody says they want to cut your throat, the last thing you should do is buy them a knife. The Ayatollah gets $100 billion of new money to be spent any way he would like without changing his behavior. He gets a pathway to a bomb and money to pay for it all. So I really do believe the deal would be disapproved. Whether or not we get 60 is still a question. But I promise you this, that the money we're going to give Iran is going to go into the war machine, not roads and bridges. In 15 years, they're going to have a nuclear device, even if they don't cheat with a missile to deliver it. So this is a horribly bad deal that will disrupt the Mideast, and the terrorist organizations that mean to hurt us and Israel will have more money. You might as well write the check to Assad, Hezbollah, and Hamas, because that's where the money's going to go, and we're going to try our best to get 60 votes to disapprove this deal.
Well, it's well said. You don't buy someone a knife when they threaten to cut your throat. And Iran has now renewed its support for Hamas terrorists. We'll be right back.
It's
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I take a back seat to no one in my commitment to the security of Israel. The people of Israel will be safer with this deal, and the same is true for the people throughout the region.
Talk about discomforting words. Talk about words where you say, you got to be kidding me. That's how many Israelis, many Americans feel about Secretary of State Kerry's words concerning Israel. This is Michael Brown, and this is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. Before I go to the phones and before I talk more about challenging God as an act of faith, I don't understand. Somebody help me understand this. Somebody help me understand this. Angela Merkel, so the German chancellor, she's surprised and disappointed that Iran hasn't changed its tone on Israel. She said in the news conference in Berlin on Monday, Jerusalem Post reporting, that she would welcome Iran's participation in the ongoing fight against ISIS in Syria. However, Iran's attitude and slander towards Israel must change. Quote, I think Iran has a lot of influence over what happens in Syria, and everyone is welcome to participate constructively in the negotiations. She added, however, that Iran's opposition to Israel needed to change in order to facilitate a joint fight in the war against ISIS. Quote, it is not acceptable how Iran continues to talk about Israel. It is a disappointment that there has been no change as far as the recognition of Israel goes. Okay, so when I say, somebody please explain this, Angela Merkel is massively more knowledgeable politically than I am. She's the Chancellor of Germany. She's got to have intelligence that I could never imagine having access to. She's got to have political experience that is not just night and day compared to mine, but different universes, because I have none. And yet it's totally obvious to me, as clear as the nose on my face, I've got a good-sized nose. It's totally obvious, totally clear, that Iran is militantly against Israel because of its religious faith. And it wants to see Israel wiped out, at the very least the Jews out of Israel, if not Israel wiped out entirely and Jews wiped out. It is militantly anti-Israel because of its radical Islamic faith. America is the great Satan. Israel is the little Satan. This is how they look at things. Why are they going to change their tone now? Why are they going to change their tune now? Why are they suddenly going to say, oh, okay, Israel is going to be our friend and our neighbor. Let's just work together now that we've got this deal. I believe that one reason that Iran wants the deal is for the instability of Israel. So this is reported by Adam Credo on freebeacon.com, Washington Free Beacon, August 27th, just a few days ago. Iran renews support for Hamas terrorists. The Islamic Republic's renewed backing of Hamas comes amid reports that relations between the two have been strained in recent months. However, Iran denies that this is the case and made clear this week that it will continue to back terrorist entities that seek Israel's destruction. Excuse me. Iran's support for all resistance groups continues similar to the past, said Marzieh Afkam, a spokeswoman for Iran's foreign ministry. She went on to stress that supporting members of the resistance front and those who stand against the Zionist regime is a principle of Iran's policy. Bad news is that it looks like, despite the opposition, President Obama is going to secure the votes that he needs to get this past Congress. A horrific thing if it does happen, and shameful if it does happen. 866-34-TRUTH. We go over to Brooklyn. Nancy, thanks so much for holding over from the last hour. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I have two quick questions for you.
Yeah.
I've been reading the Book of Josephus, and I find a place called Adiabene, but I can't find that place anywhere else in any of my dictionaries or reference books. Can you tell me where this place is? That's one. And also, how does Josephus stand among the Jewish historians?
Sure. So to answer the second question first, Josephus is our principal Jewish historian from the first century. His Antiquities of the Jews and Jewish Wars are basically the accounts that we have. The later recollections of the rabbis come from generations afterwards. Some of them may be accurate, others exaggerated or inaccurate. The historian Luke was not Jewish, writing in the New Testament. The other New Testament books, outside of talking about Jesus, are not giving us larger histories. And of course, what Luke writes is focused. So Josephus is the guy. He is the historian. Now, it's understood that he wrote with a certain perspective, being a religious Jew that would be more affiliated with Pharisees. It is true that he wrote things in such a way that Rome would be happy with him rather than want him killed. So there is a skewed perspective, but he is the historian. What he writes is considered to be our most accurate source that we have of Jewish history in the first century up until the time of his death. As for Adia Beni, if you just type it in online, if you have computer access, can easily do it, you'll spot immediately a few references down an article from the Jewish Encyclopedia. So it says there in an article by Richard Gottheil that it is a district in Mesopotamia between the upper Zav, which is Lycus, and the lower Zav, which is Caprus, through Ammianus. And you do have that again in Jewish history, in the history of the Jews by Josephus.
Right,
so it can, if you know where Nineveh is, which is in Assyria, and that was the capital of Assyria, there are some texts that indicate that Nineveh was part of that. Sometimes this was a semi-independent state, but it's in Mesopotamia. So that's in the land of the Babylonians and the Assyrians. This would be modern-day Iraq, if you can place it like that. And that's where it was located. And it had a history as being independent or as being part of other empires.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Thank sure
you.
Thing.
You've been very insightful. I love the book. I love Josephus. I'm almost finished with it. I read it every day.
Okay, good. Yeah, well, that's the historian. So,
yes.
All right, thank you for the call. Yes. I'm glad you're doing that research.
You're very all right. Welcome, and God bless you.
God bless.
Dr. Brown. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Frank, thanks also for holding, and welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I just have one quick question for you. I wanted your opinion on the large numbers of Israelites in the Old Testament. I think it says 600,000 men, and when you add women and children, it would be over 2 million.
Yep.
I know as a scholar, you're well aware of the controversy of that large amount of people and that particular region of the world that at that time. And I was just wondering your opinion. Do you go
yes,
with
sir.
Those numbers? Do you go
yeah,
with those
they're...
numbers, or do you go with the... I think the Hebrew Eleph word, which could be a tribe or
exactly.
a thousand or something. What's
exactly.
your opinion on that?
My opinion is it's a question that's fair to ask. It's not just there, Frank, but you have other accounts where it'll say, you know, 100,000 people killed in a battle, and you think, could that have been accurate? Is that what it was actually saying? So there are three ways to look at it. One is that the biblical writers were just making things up and exaggerating them wildly, and they're not telling us the truth, which obviously those of us who believe in the scriptures will dismiss that. And those of us who see how many things the biblical writers have accurately will also dismiss that. So the other two options are that, yes, between 2 and 3 million Israelites came out of Egypt, which would have been a very, very large number for the ancient world. They were supernaturally sustained in the desert. And because it's the desert just kind of eats things up, so you wouldn't have remnants and remains of the people in the desert over a period of centuries. And that's the number that took the promised land, and that the numbers are accurate. That's one way of looking at it. And that would be the most common way because it's the simplest way. And then you just look at censuses and things like that over history and biblical world. You say, okay, it does kind of line up. The other thing is, as you mentioned, the Hebrew word for thousand, Eleph, or related to aluf. did it mean not a thousand, but a tribal leader? And there are some scholars who've gone through the whole of the Old Testament where you seem to have these large numbers and have come up with a whole different way of reading them so that the numbers get reduced. It's worth looking at. I'm just not convinced that it totally works. What I'm sure of is that we have accurate information, and either it is those large numbers and it's a little surprising, but it's not impossible, or we're misinterpreting how the numbers were written by the ancient scribes. But I don't know that we've come up with a completely holistic way that works. So for me, Frank, it remains an open question, and I continue to look with interest at research on it. Thank you, sir, for asking it. Much appreciated.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Now, welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Phone lines are open. You've got questions on a Jewish-related subject. We've got answers. All right. 866-34-TRUTH, Hebrew-related question. Question on the book of Job. We're focusing a little extra on Job as I submitted my commentary to the publisher earlier this week, due out November of 2016. That's right. Got questions on Old Testament issues, things having to do with Israel today. Love to take your calls, help in any way possible. 866-34-TRUTH. It is really, really interesting, really, really interesting that the same gay activists who praised Gavin Newsom, the mayor of San Francisco, when he illegally said, go ahead and issue marriage licenses for same-sex couples. He was a hero for doing it and breaking the law. Now those same people want to crucify Kim Davis. She deserves to be in jail. She deserves to lose her job. She deserves to suffer for this. Because she's a bigot, because she won't follow the law. Fascinating, isn't it? Very interesting. 866-34-TRUTH. Oh, how about this story? Israel Today News. So it's israeltoday.co.il, that IL being Israel. Gazans risking it all to reach Israel. Palestinians raised in the Gaza Strip are taught to believe Israel is a bloodthirsty monster that desires nothing more than their destruction. Apparently, many aren't buying the lies, as the number of Gazans risking it all to seek asylum in the Jewish state is growing. Every day, Palestinians are crossing the border and telling of impossible living conditions under the Hamas regime. Initially, IDF soldiers guarding the border feared the rising number of infiltrators was a new wave of terrorist activity. But interrogations reveal that most of those crossing the fence are fleeing in fear of Hamas, willing even to risk imprisonment in Israel where at least they'll receive three meals a day. Hamas itself is working to stem this tide by establishing a security strip patrolled by its gunmen, forcing the asylum seekers to crawl long distances and then under the fence. Those who are captured on the Gaza side are executed. We were afraid of Hamas, and the patrol road they built is meant to prevent us from leaving Gaza, said one escapee in remarks published by Israel's NRG news portal. Hamas reportedly worries those who leave Gaza would become collaborators with Israel. Basically, they're just trying to have a little hope in their lives. If Hamas would use the money that pours into them to rehabilitate and restore the region, to pour it into infrastructure, to build new buildings, to build hospitals, to build apartment buildings, to rebuild homes, to build schools, to help nourish and nurture and care for their people instead of putting the money into terrorism and building terror tunnels, Hamas would do their people well, and the people would begin to thrive. If Hamas said to Israel, all right, we are the elected leadership, but we do not want to wage war with you. Let's be friends and neighbors. And they proved it. Gaza would thrive. 866-34-TRUTH. You know what? I'm going right to the phones because I like this question. Greg in Greenwich, Connecticut, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. How you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I have a question about Job's wife. I know that there's some Jewish tradition that said that Job's wife, because she said to Job, curse God and die, that they said that there was this, that basically she ended up being either put away or sometimes I heard also possibly dying, and then God replaced Job's wife with another wife. But I've always taken that verse as a woman who's broken, who's lost her children, who's seeing her husband suffer right now, and just kind of in desperation saying, just, I don't want to see you like this anymore, Job. So just want to have your take on it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, Greg. Obviously what you said was wrong, because in heaven, God is saying to the adversary, to Satan, that Job is holding fast his integrity, even though you're inciting me to destroy him without a cause. And then on the earth, his wife is saying, do you still hold on to your integrity? So the battle over his integrity is being waged, and she's on the wrong side of it. But yes, I see it the way you do, that she could not see her husband suffer any longer. And yes, probably it seemed to her that it was foolish for him to continue to praise and worship God when God had done those things to him. You still hold fast your integrity, meaning you're going to hold true to your beliefs, meaning you're not going to violate your inner conscience, meaning that you are going to be true to your convictions no matter what. Are you still holding on to that? So what she said was wrong, and hence he rebukes her as speaking like one of the foolish women. But that being said, yes, I do believe it's out of brokenness and pain. No, there's no evidence that he gets a new wife. He gets everything else new, even new children, but it does not say a new wife. So the assumption is the same wife. And in the other traditions that we have about this, a book called The Testament of Job, which is just a mythical expansion. It's not the real deal, but it's a mythical expansion. His wife actually has the name Cystis, and she sacrifices for him and even cuts her hair and sells it to help support them. And then at a certain point, she does complain and things like that. But yes, your take is right. It was too much solidarity with her husband in suffering and not enough solidarity with God. But I don't look at it that she was some kind of evil woman and that, you know, that's why, you know, bad things happen, a bad wife, you know, all this nonsense. I don't see it like that at all. I think your take is accurate.
Yeah. Great. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to the commentary. I just thought it was really interesting that after all this was said and done, that Job never cursed God, which was the whole bet in the first place between Satan and God. And so I just
what's interesting, of course, he curses the day of his birth, beginning in the third chapter. Yeah. And then he begins to really lash out against God. But in the sense, he's already passed his test, and now it's kind of the next phase of the discussion here. But in fact, no, he doesn't curse God, but he does accuse God. And ultimately, God says in chapter 42, verse 7, that the friends did not speak what was right concerning God as Job did. So in what ways did he speak what was right? Does it simply mean that he repented at the end and said, I'm small, I shouldn't have said any of this, and God forgives him and says, you spoke what's right in repenting? I don't believe so. I believe he spoke what was right in that he knew that this was contrary to the character of God to act like this, that a God who acted like this would be like a monster assaulting him. And without knowing there was more to the story, he did speak rightly about God in that respect. So, yeah, commentary should be out November. It's a serious academic commentary, but I wrote it really hoping that any seriously interested student in the book of Job, not knowing any Hebrew or anything like that, would really be into be able to dig in and profit by it. So next November, I'll be eager, November of next year. God bless. Thank you for the question.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks for joining us on the line of fire. 866-34-TRUTH is that number to call. Let me share with you a little bit from one of the essays that closes out my Job commentary. And this is on challenging God as an act of faith. And I write there that God, having created us in his image, which means that we should love justice and be repulsed by evil, welcomes pushback from his faithful ones when he appears to be acting unjustly. Did you get that? Having created us in his image, which means that we should love justice and be repulsed by evil, he welcomes pushback from his faithful ones when he appears to be acting unjustly. So it is precisely this truth that, in my opinion, helps explain why the Lord commended Job in 42:7, Job 42:7, for speaking what was right concerning him, in contradistinction from the friends who did not. Indeed, in one of the most profound scenes from a Nazi concentration camp, and one that's almost unimaginable for many Christian readers, a small group of Jewish men, Elie Wiesel being one of them, a small group of Jewish men conducted a formal trial in which they concluded that the Almighty was guilty, in Hebrew, chayav, which means owing, as in owing these prisoners something, after which they joined together for evening prayers. You say, what in the world? They have a trial and they pronounce God guilty? As if he's guilty of war crimes or something like that? And then they go pray? Because they saw that as part of their relationship. He's still God. They still reverence him. They're still going to pray to him and praise him. But they have an issue with how he's acted. While some would count this blasphemous, others see it as an expression of faith. So I quote from a very penetrating and powerful essay, 1973, by the influential Jewish philosopher Eliezer Berkowitz. And it's entitled Faith After the Holocaust. So he tied together the themes of Jewish suffering, wrestling with God in the book of Job. Again, this is part of an essay at the close of the commentary, of these five essays at the end of the commentary. I think it'll just stay there at five. Maybe more will ultimately be added in, but I don't think so. And this is on challenging God as an act of faith. And the commentary, if you missed it, won't be out until November of 2016. So Berkowitz writes this, undoubtedly, for our generation, writing in 1973, Auschwitz represents the supreme crisis of faith. It would be a spiritual tragedy if it were otherwise. After the Holocaust, Israel's first religious responsibility is to reason with God and, if need be, to wrestle with him. So, you see, friends, for Jews, this religious responsibility that he speaks of goes back to Abraham's extended dialogue with the Lord in Genesis 18, where he has the boldness to ask, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to put the righteous to death with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? So here is Abraham, who reverentially is challenging God. Oh, in a respectful way. But he's saying, you're not doing a wrong thing, are you? I mean, if you found 50 righteous people in Sodom, you're not going to wipe it out. You spare it for 50, right? Well, let me push a little further. How about for 40? How about for 30? Look, the judge of all the earth, you're going to do what's right. You're not going to sweep away the righteous with the wicked, are you? So Berkowitz says this reasoning with God is a need of faith. It issues from the very heart of faith. Well, in Elie Wiesel's Night, his famous book, Night, at the hanging of a little boy, someone asked, where is God now? It is the right question to be asked. Not to ask it would have been blasphemy. Faith cannot pass by such horror in silence. Faith, because it is trust in God, demands justice of God. It cannot countenance God's involvement in injustice and cruelty. That's one of the great lessons from the book of Job.
Flame, send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
As Khan delved further into the Shemitah, its mystery grew ever deeper, ever more expansive and stunning. It touched virtually everything, from Wall Street to world wars, to events of the 21st century. The new revelations resulted in the book entitled The Mystery of the Shemitah, which, as with The Harbinger, also became a New York Times bestseller from the first week of its release.
That to me is one of the most intriguing questions of all, is how have these books become New York Times bestsellers? I'm not saying that proves the book is true, but it gets my attention and it makes me wonder. 866-34-TRUTH. This is Michael Brown. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And this week's special resource offer is a Thoroughly Jewish resource because it looks at the biblical calendar. It says, looks like the clock is still ticking because these massive economic downturns and the famous Black Monday, the infamous Black Monday, and some of the horrific things that have happened in the in recent American history with massive stock market crashes and economic crises have happened right at the seventh year cycle of ancient Israel's calendar and right at the year of release, which had to do with economic equality, and right at a time in the fall when it would be the time of that very year coming to an end. So it's interesting. To me, it gets my attention. You say, but look, someone raised this argument. I thought it was a great point. They said, look at this. The fact of the matter is that when God brought judgment on Israel for not celebrating the seventh year, right? Not honoring that, not letting the land rest, not walking in faith, not keeping the Sabbath on the seventh year. When they did that, then God let the land rest. The Jewish people went to exile 490 years because of 70 cycles that they did not, they went into exile for 70 years for 490 years of not keeping these cycles. So every seventh year, right? Seven times 70. So the land rested and the poor could eat from it and things like that. You say the stock markets crashed and the rich got richer and the poor got poorer, and how did that work? And I'm not looking for an exact correspondence. I'm asking the question, is God getting our attention? So take a minute, go to the website, Ask Dr. Brown, askdrbrown.org. When you go there, just click on the resource offer. I talk about this a little bit more, Jonathan Cahn's book and the DVD, and then you can watch it, all right? Watch it, check it out, and then come to your own conclusion. But take advantage of it. Get the book and the DVD. I think you'll be enriched by it. 866-34-TRUTH. Here's an interesting question. Job dividing equally of his inheritance among male and female children, a model for future generations. How does that work with the New Testament giving to grandchildren? I'm not sure about the New Testament giving to grandchildren part, exactly what that means. But for sure, what Job did was unusual in the culture. That was definitely something unusual. Maybe it showed a special heart for justice for all from Job. Very, very interesting, though, for sure. All right, so let me just share a little bit more from the essay of Eliezer Berkovits on faith after the Holocaust from the essay at the close of one of the closing essays of my commentary on Job due out November of 2016. So according to Berkovits, faith cannot countenance God's involvement in injustice and cruelty, and yet for faith, God is involved in everything under the sun. What faith is searching for is, if not to understand fully, at least to gain a hint of the nature of God's involvement. This questioning of God with the very power of faith stands out as a guidepost at the earliest beginnings of the Jewish way in history. Abraham wrestled with God over the fate of Sodom and Gomorrah. We note how the man who in his piety sees himself as mere dust and ashes nonetheless has the audacity to challenge God with the word, "Shall the judge of all the earth not do justice?" There is no contradiction here. The man of faith questions God because of his faith. Are you getting this? It is the faith of Abraham in God that cannot tolerate injustice of the part of God. This is also the essence of Job's dilemma. The sustained fire of his plaint is derived not from his personal plight, but from the passion of his faith. There is no weakening of faith with Job. On the contrary, it is the very power of the faith that lends force to the accusation. What has happened to Job is wrong. It is terribly wrong because it is judged by the ideal of justice that Job formed for himself on the strength of his faith in God. That Job will not accept the arguments of his friends in defense of divine providence is not a matter of stubborn self-righteousness, nor is it due to a sense of exaggerated self-importance. What the friends attempt to do is to defend wrong as justice. By doing so, without being aware of it, they degrade Job's idea of God. Because of his faith, Job cannot accept a defense of God that implies an insult to the dignity of God in whom he believes. So, as I say, I believe this is an articulate explanation of why God commended Job for what he said, but rebuked the friends in chapter 42, verse 7. So a little bit more from Berkowitz. He said, the questioning of God's providence in the death camps in the Holocaust was taking place within the classical tradition of Judaism. Unfortunately, unlike the case of Job, God remained silent to the very end of the tragedy, and the millions in the concentration camps were left alone to shift for themselves in the midst of infinite despair. To this day, theologians are arguing about the meaning of God's answer to Job. Be that as it may, one thing is certain. In the denouement, so when God appears to Job, when God speaks from the whirlwind, he makes himself known to him. This just is able to find peace with God in the words. Ah, I've got a typo there. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Wherefore abhor my words, and I repent, seeing I am dust and ashes. Do you understand this concept? Yes, on the one hand, it is absolutely wrong to grumble and complain. And for human beings, limited as we are and sinful as we are, to malign God, to think we have the right to accuse him. And that's one of the things that God reveals to Job. He reveals his greatness. He reveals his glory. He reveals his power. He reveals his majesty. He reveals his wisdom. And Job's thinking, oh, what an idiot. I mean, how in the world could I have had the audacity, the foolish audacity, to accuse God of not running his universe properly? He utterly renounces that. At the same time, God says, you spoke what was right concerning me. Again, because his faith in God said something was wrong. His faith in God challenged God because he knew this was not the way things were supposed to be. And there is a faith that says, God, you promised. In fact, it reminds me of a famous story from the Hebrides revival, which took place off the coast of Scotland in the Hebrides Islands from 1949 to 1952. And during that time, God was mightily using Duncan Campbell, and great outpourings were coming in his meetings. They moved to another parish, another location in the Hebrides Islands, and nothing happened the opening meeting. In fact, it was as if proverbially the heavens were brass, and there seemed really real indifference to the meetings, the young people not in the meetings, just the type of thing they were fighting in different places. I forget all the nature of the resistance there, but they ran into it. So they were discouraged because they've heard of God moving and outpouring and great things happening. But no, it's not happening now in these new meetings in this new location. But they knew they had prayed. They knew they'd been crying out to God. They had a promise among them from Isaiah 44 that they applied spiritually, that God would pour out water on the thirsty land. So after the meeting was over, one of the men said, why don't we go to one of the houses and pray? So they went to the house, and it was the house, a solidly built house, which comes into play in a moment. Got a concrete, solidly built house. They went to pray, and they prayed till about midnight. About midnight, Duncan Campbell asked the blacksmith to pray. and he prayed for a half an hour. That's a long time to lead in prayer. At the end of it, he said, God, you promised to pour out water on the thirsty land, and you're not doing it. And then he paused. And then he said, don't you know that your honor is at stake? And he paused again. And then he said, I challenge you to keep your covenant commitment. I'll tell you what happened on the other side of the break.
Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Always gets the foot tapping. Third of Jewish Thursday, Michael Brown. Thanks for joining us here on the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. All right, so clarification on a question I was asked earlier. Now, it's not New Testament about the righteous man stirring up for children's children. That's Proverbs, although it's a concept elsewhere in Scripture. But that just means that when you're blessed, when you obey the Lord, you're blessed, and that blessing doesn't just accrue to you but to your kids and your grandkids, because there is blessing for the future generations, and you've stored up wisely in addition to that. There's even more in this essay, this appendix at the end of the book, my commentary on Job. As I said, there are five of these essays. The one I shared some of it with you now was essay number two, Challenging God as an Act of Faith. The first essay at the back of my Job commentary, which again I just submitted to the publisher on Tuesday of this week, so it's just in the early stages of editing, the goal being to have it out fall of next year. So the first essay is, who was the adversary? Because there's a being called Satan, or the adversary, in the first chapter of the book. Who is he? You say, well, it's obviously Satan. He's the devil. Well, the Hebrew ha-satan just means the adversary. So is he like a prosecuting attorney among God's angels? Is he kind of the eyes and the ears of kind of a secret police that God has, some scholars maintain? Is he merely a man, as one medieval Jewish scholar maintained, and the sons of God among whom he appears are the Israelites? Is he clearly an angelic being and a fallen one, a hostile one? Hence, the Septuagint, the Greek translation, calls him the devil, which would then be in harmony with what the New Testament says about him. In Revelation 12, he accuses us before the throne of God day and night. That would seem to be what he's doing. In Zechariah 3, he's accusing Joshua the high priest. And in Job 1, he's accusing Job before the Lord. But if so, is he fully the devil of the New Testament? To me, he is a foreshadowing of the devil of the New Testament. Ultimately, one and the same being, but foreshadowed here. And then we get to see who he is fully in the New Testament. All right. Right at the beginning of the show, we announced that Kim Davis, county clerk in Kentucky, who in conscience said she cannot issue marriage licenses because of her faith, she cannot issue them to same-sex couples, she has been found in contempt of court and sentenced to jail. So, of course, there's an outpouring of support for her among believers. I believe there should be even more support for her. I know there's controversy. You just resign. I understand the issues there. When you put yourself in her shoes and you realize she's an elected official and she's worked there for many, many, many years, and this is something she prayed about and felt she couldn't capitulate on, and there are very easy fixes for the governor. I believe, for example, if Mike Huckabee was the governor of Kentucky right now, that he would act differently, and based on other statements he's made, and that he could simply say, we have religious exemptions, and it's that simple. And there are other ways around this as well. I'm looking at ridiculous comments. Someone tweeted this out. Kim Davis is like a person who, for religious reasons, uses illegal drugs or refuses to pay his income tax. yeah, so, I mean, the attack and the vilification and so on. And I can't respond to all of these tweets here. Obviously, I'm doing radio now, plus can't respond to all of them anyway. But we did, at the very beginning of the show, I made a statement. I explained this is exactly where I wrote my book, Outlast in the Gay Revolution, knowing this is what we're coming into. And the very first chapter of the book, the very first principle, after the introduction, the day the line was crossed, the very first principle is never compromise your convictions. And I say there in the book, in Outlast in the Gay Revolution, I say it's going to be costly. It's going to be costly. And we're going to have to take our stand. And I quote Billy Graham, courage is contagious. When a brave man takes a stand, the spines of others are often stiffened. And I say it's time to strengthen our resolve. So I made a brief statement, maybe 2.5 minutes long. It's up on video, all right? We were able to turn this around. So this was the beginning of my radio show less than 2 hours ago. But we have video equipment to record everything we do in our studio now. And it is already up. Here's my response to the jailing of County Kirk Kim Davis for refusal to violate her faith. It's already getting a good amount of views and comments. So check it out. It's on Facebook or on our YouTube channel. So go to AskDrBrown.org and just click on the YouTube channel. And there it is. This was recorded just less than 2 hours ago. And you can watch it online. My statement, there is a reason, friends, that the first principle of the book is never compromise your convictions. And this is what I say. No matter what pressures put on you, the loss of status, being kicked out of your denomination, losing a pension or a position or a raise or a scholarship, being disowned by family or friends, loss of income, do not compromise your biblically based convictions. The moment you do, something in you dies. You're no longer free, but you're a slave to public opinion and public sway, and you have sacrificed your integrity on the altar of expediency. What could possibly be worth a loss like that? I'm not talking about being stubborn and unreasonable or about believing falsehoods about gays and lesbians. I'm talking about being true to your convictions, especially those that are based on the clear teachings of the Bible, about doing what is right rather than what is convenient or politically correct. We owe it to God, our society, and to future generations. After all, and this is from my book, Outlast in the Gay Revolution, if we cave in and compromise, who will be left to stand? That's why the attack on people of faith has intensified greatly in the last few years. You can be sure that gay activists are in this for the long haul. Wouldn't you be if you were in their shoes? After all, this is about their very lives, and I fully understand why they do what they do. That's why this issue is completely unavoidable. Would you please pray with me that the Lord would use Outlasting the Gay Revolution to help spark and deepen a moral and cultural revolution in America? Would you pray with me that this would become a manifesto for a holy, God-moved, spirit-driven counterculture revolution? Countercultural revolution, a Jesus revolution, not fought with anger, hatred, intimidation, violence, God forbid, but fought with the love of God, the truth of God, the Spirit of God, prayer, and God's people standing up for what's right. I'll say it again, we need backbones of steel with hearts of compassion. That is, so to say, the winning formula. That is what will turn the tide. That is what will ultimately stand the test. And by God's grace, we'll stand. Would you pray with me? Would you tell a friend about Outlasting the Gay Revolution? It is a book for such a time as this. My bottom line today, if your heart is wounded, if you feel that God has let you down, be honest with Him. He will prove Himself to be utterly faithful.